So I went out with my high school, a friend from high school, to like do the experiment. And I told him beforehand, hey, you know, this is really important. We got to do we're on a mission, like stop at two. So like, you know, like I'm just telling you beforehand. And of course, like 14 drinks later, we're driving home.
Yeah.
and like, it's not like nothing happened. I dropped him off. I drove back to my parents' house. I, you know, just the way I would do in high school, I opened their doorknob very quietly and like try not to wake their dogs and like pulled the door shut. And I remember the second I pulled the door shut and that little click happened, mm-hmm. I remembered the experiment. I was like, fuck, the experiment.
The experiment failed.
The experiment failed. And that was enough. That was enough.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. Now you guys can clap. All right. Today we have filmmaker Aaron Strand from Athens, Georgia. He is the director and writer of Withdrawal, an award-winning feature film about a couple battling heroin addiction that was inspired by real events. And we are very excited. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm great.
Okay, you just look so scared for a second.
Oh, no. I assure you, I'm not terrified. No, I'm great.
Awesome. Well, we're very excited.
What's up? What were you saying?
Yeah. Do we need to, like, rap battle real quick?
Oh, God, please no.
But we're very excited to have you here tonight.
Yeah, thrilled to be here.
So let's just jump right in. You know, Withdrawal just came out recently, right? How are you feeling about all of that?
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey. I, you know, we talk about gratitude like a lot in the program, and I'm kind of overwhelmed with it. You know, I've been sober for 13 years. 10 of those years, you know, like I would be making New Year's resolutions of like, this is the year I'm going to finish a feature film, and it took a really long time to cross that finish line. There was a lot of false starts along the way and kind of barriers. So to have it done, and for not only to feel a sense of, to get a positive audience response and to see people engaging with the film in the ways that you dream of as an artist, right? Of like seeing people actually reacting in a theater space. People coming up to you and opening up and sharing their own stories, you know, because the film has somehow created a safety and a trust with the audience. I mean, this is like a dream come true. And then on top of that, also feel a sense of personal satisfaction where it's a piece of work that I'm incredibly proud of. You know, I've been an artist my entire life. That is like not always the case. You know, sometimes you have to trot something out because, you know, you're obligated to, or there's some money behind it or whatever. And deep down inside, you're like, oh, I think this is kind of shit. But that's not the case with this film. You know, like I'm really proud of this work, and the journey that it has been on has been a complex. You know, this is the farthest I've ever gotten in terms of releasing a feature film into the world, which is like a whole it's a whole crazy kind of process. So but all in all, just incredibly grateful to be in this position.
That's awesome. And what was the process like getting this whole thing together? Like, how long did it take to go from like pre-production to now?
Yeah, so I think the ball really started rolling about 3 years ago, to like right in January 3 years ago.
So the New Year's resolution actually stuck.
Well, I guess so. I guess you could say that. Well, the truth is, it was actually born out of a resentment.
Like, you're like, well, actually.
No. It was born out of resentment. I had another feature. I had some producers attached to it. I thought the ball was rolling on that. And then they broke up with me via email. And I was fuming like so bad. And I was more just like, I gotta make a feature film before these fuckers do, you know? Like, I'm just like, like, I've got, like, this is bullshit. And, but it was right around that time that it, it, the, everything kind of clicked for me because, like, I've been wanting to tell, it's not that I only want to tell addiction stories, but obviously that's my experience. I want to share these type of stories. But I never found like a sort of genre container for it or never trusted it. Every time I started writing, I'd kind of go off on these tangents and maybe the story would get too big, certainly for the budgets that I was working with. But the second I allowed the story to just be a simple contained two-hander, as in like just two characters interacting with each other, and that deciding that the genre of the story was going to be a love story, that's when everything sort of clicked into place. And I began to feel comfortable moving forward. And I felt that like I could say what I wanted to about the addiction experience while telling a compelling human drama at the same time.
Because I feel like telling an addiction story can be challenging, like to get it out of the little niche, right? Because the recovery community is going to go apeshit every time there's something recovery related. They're like, oh, this is so cool. This is so powerful. It's like, I feel like it can be easy to like create something that the recovery community is going to enjoy. But then when you can break the wall and you have like normal people, and then like, normies get so offended when I call them normies. When non-addicts and non-alcoholics, you know, can observe a piece of media or read like a story or something and also find it compelling and it has addiction in it, I feel like that is very hard to do. And do you feel like by doing like this two-hander format and making it a love story, do you feel like this has kind of like been able to break that wall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people are able to watch it, and even if they have, and look, like, I think almost everybody in America at this point is touched by addiction in one way, shape, or form, whether they want to admit it or not. However, by using that sort of tried and true genre format, it allows normies to see themselves in the characters, even if they've never, you know, if they've never shot dope or whatever. You know, the other thing that I think is really hard about telling addiction stories is that so often you have to walk this very fine line, because it's very easy to go into sort of romanticizing, glorifying, because, like, you know, let's be real, like, for a while drugs and alcohol was super fun before it became not super fun, right?
Yeah.
And so it's easy to slip into that. Now, on the opposite side, you can go full PSA mode, and all of a sudden you're preaching to an audience, telling them what you think they should believe, you're talking down to them, and I hate that as well. Like, you know, talk about recoiling from like a hot flame.
You're like Uno reverse.
such a stupid joke. But
if you know, you know.
So to try to tell just an honest story where we're showing characters dealing with these things, we're not making any moral judgment upon them. We're allowing them to live within their own contained space. I don't think I could do that as a writer, as a filmmaker, if I was sort of just dedicated to telling an addiction story, a recovery story. It needs other genre engines to kind of carry us to the heights of human drama that all the stories, I think, should be aspiring to.
Yeah. Do you know, are you familiar with that show, The Pit?
Yeah, okay. My wife watches it.
So we just finished watching season one, and there's something that show did that I appreciated so much, because they did touch on addiction a lot, because, you know, it follows a day in an ER.
Right.
And there's a lot of, like, there's overdose in there, and then there's, you know, addicts and everything. And one episode, one of the characters says, "Do I look like an addict to you?" And the doctor was like, "Yes, because an addict can be anyone." And I was just like, I was just so happy to see that, because so oftentimes, you know, in media, it's like the addict it's always placed as, it's a moral failure. You know, like, you know, there's the willpower is not strong enough. There's, you know, it's some sort of judgment on an addict, as opposed to an addict can be anybody. An addict doesn't look a certain type of way. An addict is literally these three people, right?
Yeah.
You know, our entire studio audience is all different flavors, varieties, and fonts of addicts. But a lot of times in you know, film and TV, it is, you know, the junkie on the street. It's the drunk underneath the bridge. And it's like, you know, destigmatizing it also turns into, like, how do we truthfully tell these stories?
Yeah. So often as well, you it's very easy. And I've been guilty of this in writing in the past. I don't think anything that's ever made it to screen, but I certainly fall into the trope. It's very easy to fall into sort of victim narratives around characters that are dealing with drug and alcohol issues. You think in the moment as you're banging out your first draft that you're creating some sort of sympathetic pathos for them, but you're actually removing them of the autonomy of their own story. So what I think is really important, what I tried to do with withdrawal, is you have to show characters making active choices early in their life that they actually want to pursue this, right? Like no one held my arm down and like put a needle in it. No one forced my mouth open and like shoved a bottle of pills in it or a bottle of vodka, right? Like I chose these things. Like, and yes, the like we talk about like the, we've lost the power of choice, but you know, early on in my experimenting days, like I was definitely like, I consciously thought I was pursuing something. And I think that that gives dignity and power to the characters, because when they choose a different choice in life, when they choose recovery, when they choose to better themselves, you're honoring that choice in the same way, right? In the same way that you just, you know, you don't like stumble into it. And choices, characters making choices, is the essential quality of compelling drama. You know, we talk in the writing world, we talk all of the times about you can't have a passive protagonist. You can't have a protagonist where things are just happening to them. Mm-hmm. And so that is another really important thing for me in the storytelling around these types of characters, making sure that they have autonomy throughout the course of their lives.
Yeah, I think that's really important and can be a beautiful thing to show, because, you know, a lot of times people do talk about, it's like, oh, well, you never had to pick it up in the first place. And it's like, okay, but like you did, and then you didn't get addicted. Mm-hmm. And so it's like that shame around the same decision, just one person went somewhere with addiction and the other person, you know, went in like the normal consumption route of things, or like the people who party really hard and then just stop. Like I so badly wanted to be that person, but yeah. I knew early on, I was like, I'm coping, like this is coping, but it's working, so it's not a problem, like it's actually helping. And then like I would have like those glimpses of like, oh, this is gonna end bad. I'm like, oh, but right now it's fine. Yeah. And then like in that moment, like in those early days, if I would have put it down, absolutely, like I probably could have, right? But I didn't want to. And mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's like, well, my friends don't have to, my family doesn't have to, so it's like, why do I have to? And so like, you know, it's fun until it's not, especially yeah. Like now everyone's posting like the stuff about like, oh, 2016, this is what life was like. I have seen, my feed is full of party videos and I'm just like, oh, aren't man. We sober guys? Like, are we glorifying this right now? Mm-hmm. Like, do you miss it? Do you need to, are you okay? Because it is so easy to slip back into that glorification of like, oh, this yeah. was so bad. But like, remember when it wasn't?
Yeah.
Like, but I feel like I've seen that turn into relapse so quickly, because it's like you forget, what is it? The pain and the misery of whatever. I don't know. Yeah. I'm bad at quoting things, but yeah. it's really easy to forget how bad it got, because your brain's still just trying to protect you and be like, no, like this was good, this was fun.
Yeah.
I compare it to giving birth. That when you give birth, it's like this extremely painful experience, but you quickly forget and you get pregnant again. And it's like, oh my gosh, these contractions, they hurt so much. But you forget. Like, you don't remember the pain, like what that felt like. And that's kind of the way that I think about it, especially when people are remembering like the fun times, the good times. Because like, you know, 2016, you know, I'm in my early 20s, it was a completely different experience than when I was drinking and partying in my early 30s, where it's like a party by myself, you know?
Woo, woo!
Yeah. Party of one.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's where, you know, one of the greatest first gifts that the program and meetings gave to me was this insistence upon storytelling and taking narrative control of your life. Mm-hmm. Because when I came in, when I was first getting sober, I had no cohesive through line, right? Like, I thought I was like unlucky, or like someone had like cursed me. You know what I mean? Like I was like, is someone like a witch like somewhere? You know, like, yeah. Like literally, like,
yeah,
I was so
crack an egg. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, I could not put two and two together that the fact that I could not go an hour without using mm-hmm. was ruining my life and had led me to homelessness, you know? And so the fact that the program was like, no, you're gonna, you need to start cobbling together. I mean, a fourth step is nothing but like a series of story beats that you're having to cobble together. And eventually, if someone asks you to share and tell your story, you know, you're gonna have to try to put a narrative through line together. Mm-hmm. And this is such a gift because it allows you to see how one thing leads to another. And that excited me so much that I you know, tried to make a I guess you could call it a career out of it.
I guess you could call it a career.
You know, life in the
really
life in the arts, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, you know, like and what's so cool about making movies and telling stories is that you can give people to that, and you can give it to them even in more sort of like emotional visual terms, which allow people who don't have personal experience to experience it themselves. And that's an awesome gift.
And so was withdrawal based off of like a particular story, or was it just kind of like inspired by the generality of what addiction can look like?
Well, you know, there's definitely a lot of like specificity, in that. One of the things that I was really fortunate about is that I got to make this movie completely on my own terms. And the way I always wanted to make a movie, the way I wish someone had allowed me to make a movie, because I started in this industry as an actor, is I wanted to give actors this really, really long rehearsal process where they could make the story with me, where we could really like dive deep into characters, and we could collaboratively build the script together. So when I cast the two actors who play the two leads in Withdrawal, Millie Rose Evans and Brent Michael, I didn't know them at all. And I only had like a 10-page treatment, you know, basically like a short story version of the film. And we got together in my living room twice a week for 4 months, like fleshing out the story, allowing them to find the characters' voices in themselves, and developing like a lot of beats. You know, I kind of knew how it began, I knew how it ended, I knew the rough sort of act structure, but it was really that collaborative work that brought the film to life. And so, you know, and the reason why I bring this up is because while there's a lot of specificity that goes into moments of this film, you know, It's not like the Aaron Strand autobiography movie, right? Like these characters exist on their own terms, and we earned that right by working together. And it owes so much to also these two actors who were willing and gave themselves over to this type of process. And I just find that sort of stuff like so much fun.
That's fucking incredible. Like I always think like the best creative work is done in collaboration.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, you know, as like I've been a creative my whole life also, and I was also a loner. And so I'm like so used to like doing that stuff on my own. And so I was working a job at one point where we had like this little A-frame, and every month, and it was like one of those, like we had chalk markers and stuff. Mm. And so like one day my boss randomly, it was Pride Month, and she was like, hey, like, can you do something gay on it? And I'm like, yeah, would love to. Thanks. and so that like then just doing the A-frame every month just kind of became something that I did. Like she asked me to do every month. And then we got someone in who wanted to help me with it. And I was like, I don't want to, like, this is my baby. Like, I don't want to. Don't help me. But then the A-frames that we started designing together, like, just turned out so cool. It was just awesome. Like, she was really good at, like, lettering and stuff. And then, like, I could, like, do the little drawings. And, like, they're just so beautiful. And, like, customers would, like, always, like, comment on how, like, they would look forward to what they looked like each month. And I don't know. It was just fun. And, like, that was so – like, it sounds so dumb, like, my little coffee shop job. But, like, it completely transformed how I look at creativity. Because now, like, I love creating with other creatives. Like, now, like, my partner and I, like, when we sit down and, like, write a script together, we just, like – play off each other, and it, like, I don't know, I really feel like what we make in the end turns out to be way better than something like I could have made on my own. Has nothing to do with his cinema camera or anything like that. But you know, it's just like in collaboration can be, you know, it's like the opposite of addiction is connection, and you know, we need you know, like the importance of community and all those stupid things that are actually really important. But I think the creative process has been like how I've learned, like, oh, wow, like working with somebody else can actually be so beneficial. It can be so, and it can be beautiful at the same time, and not just like, you know, like, oh, hiss at somebody because that's what I always did.
Yeah.
So that's really cool to hear about, like, forming these characters with the actors. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some filmmakers, like, out in the world who kind of, like, use this model that I've always looked up to. And so it was really cool to try to bring it into practice. The other cool thing about forming that community through the process, not only is that, like, when you're, because, like, you know, we're releasing this movie. This is a micro budget level film, mm-hmm. and we are releasing it completely independently, totally DIY, $0 of marketing budget. Mm-hmm. And we spent every dollar that we had to finish the movie. Yeah. And so you need a community to mm-hmm. support the film through all these different eras and life cycles that it goes through. The festival life cycle, just the world premiere that we did at Atlanta Film Festival, that was like a whole journey to get there. And then, you know, we're taking it across the country to all these different places, and we're trying to, you know, let people know, because the problem with independent art, you know, is, I mean, there's so many problems with independent art. Number one, ain't no money. number one. Number two is that sorry, I was cringing. Yeah, I was cringing at my own point number one. Number two is discovery that nobody knows your shit exists. No one really cares.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everyone is no without having a personal connection to it. It's very hard to get somebody to take a risk on seeing an independent film that they've never heard of. And I get it. You know, I'm choosing to stay on my couch most nights of the week. And so it's a tremendous amount of work to put yourself forward and to be the mascot, the spokesperson, the poster child for a piece of work, and say that, no, I think you're really going to dig this. This is why we did this. This is the thought behind it. We could, as an independent filmmaker, we kind of bash on the Hollywood system or on the star system so often, but it's not like we're doing anything different. The only thing that a Hollywood star system is doing is attaching a face that that many people are comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And they're treating that basically as like a stamp of approval of like, oh, if so-and-so agreed to do this project, therefore it must be of merit, and therefore it's worth my $12.50 at the box office or what have you.
$12.50? Yeah.
Well, 1875.
Yeah. This is like NCG versus AMC. Like.
I was just playing a movie in Athens last night, and where I think the standard ticket price is $12.50. So that's why it was okay in my head. But yes.
Sorry, I word vomited because I went to the movies recently and I spent a lot of money.
Oh my god!
See, the last time I went to the movies,
yeah,
it was saw Five Nights at Freddy's.
Oh
yeah, it's very expensive opening weekend. That's why I was like $12.50.
Yeah, I feel you.
I did the Downton Abbey movie opening weekend. $8 matinee. Let's go.
Oh, matinee prices.
There we go. Yeah, that's cheapest birthday gift ever. when we went to concessions and I bought my sister her snack, she was like, "Are you sure?" I was like, "Your ticket was $8. Get whatever you want." Like,
that's awesome. But you know, like it's hard to convince people to separate, because I, you know, and I don't even think, even though we could talk about that, we could argue about ticket prices and like that they're too high, and the studios and the cinemas are really squeezing value, and we feel squeezed as customers. The truth is that I think the essential value proposition of a film is it's hard for people to sacrifice that time. Mm-hmm. The 2 hours of the theater plus the driving, the parking, you know, you're asking for a 3 hour commitment, mm-hmm. at a time when everybody's life, it feels so tight and compressed, and we're so demanded upon in so many ways, mm-hmm. as Americans in 2026. And so I get that that's a really tough value proposition to ask of people. And even with a film that it's like, we've won awards, we've won all these things, but even that is like still not enough. Like you need to step forward. And the whole reason why I brought this all up is that you need a community, mm-hmm. to come behind you and say, hey, no, this is actually something that's really, really good. Like you guys should check this out. And it's the only way that things like this can grow, that like art like this can survive. So yeah, all that starts that starts on the very first moment that you agree to get the project rolling together, right? Like every single person you talk to from that moment on, hopefully you're inviting to join in that coalition that's going to have to keep working throughout the lifetime of a project like this, which is, you know, I saw someone post on Instagram the other day. They said, "I don't make films. I make multi-decade community art projects."
That's the most pretentious thing.
It's true. It like, resonates.
But like, it's so like anytime I hear something like that where it's like, it's not poetry, it's whatever, I'm just like, I just hear like,
I don't think that was their intention behind. Okay. I think their intention was like, I wish I could just make films. Instead, I'm having to make 20 or 30 year investments in community building in order to like spread this piece and mm-hmm. and potentially see any return on all of the work that I've put into it. You know, yeah. that's what they're saying. Like, I wish I could be a filmmaker. I am instead an exhibitor. I am like a social media, like, you know, I'm a professional Instagram poster. Like, I wish I could spend all my time filmmaking. Yeah. And that's just not the reality when you're playing on this stakes level of the casino.
Yeah.
So you've done everything from like the, you don't have like a marketing person, a PR person, you're doing.
With what money?
I was going to say, did you hear about the small budget?
That's what I'm saying.
You couldn't even afford a reason to.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
That's,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, how do you manage, like, how do you, the time?
I don't know.
Do you sleep?
I don't know. No.
And your dad.
My mail lady came up to me yesterday because she wanted to see the baby. And then but she's always giving me shit. And she came up and she was like, "You look tired." I was like, when Jamise is telling me that I'm looking tired, I know.
You're like, put the mail in the fucking box.
Now there was.
I would never say that to Jamise.
I'm just kidding.
First of all, I think Jamise might punch me in the face if I did that.
No, totally kidding.
No, there was a day last year we were shooting on location all day just for like this little music video, right? And I had to go to Clemson for this, and it was just all day. So I woke up in the morning, left for Clemson, did my whole thing all day, then got home late, like knocked out, whatever. My friend texts me the next day, and we haven't like caught up in a while, and like there's this cat that's sleeping on my chest. And I'm like, look at this cat. It's so cute. But it's a selfie, right? And she focuses in. She was like, "You need sleep." I'm like, wow. Thanks for ignoring the cat and pointing out the obvious. I'm like, but whatever. I got home at 2 a.m. I don't know what you want. Like, what do you want from me?
Yeah.
But no, like it is it's not easy to get the word out there to, you know, get people, especially like establishing trust. Cause yeah, you absolutely have to establish trust. Cause what you said about in like the Hollywood format is a certain name being on there is that stamp of approval, because there is such like a distrust where it's like, you like, oh, like this is a so-and-so movie and then it's bad. This just feels like a gut punch. It's like, I just like invest. Like I personally, it pisses me off when I watch a bad movie because I'm like, now I can't get those 2 hours back. It also pisses me off that all movies are like 2+ hours now.
That's
and
what
I'm like, guys.
Say, yeah. Like, yeah.
Withdrawal, 93 minutes.
I love you.
93 minutes.
Like, that's how it used to
be.
That's all right. Why did you lead with that?
I heard this thing recently that movies are that long now because writers factor in the fact that people's attention spans are so short that they write in preparation of people being on their phone distracted, and that's why the characters will repeat themselves throughout the movie, and like basically like at every 30 minute mark they're like repeating the storyline, like, so wait, we're about to go to your ex-boyfriend's house and try to win him back with the clothes on your back and this bag and your grandma's rings. Yeah, we're gonna take this out. And then they like repeat it because they're writing, factoring that people are going to be on their phones distracted.
Yeah,
that's why it's so long.
Yeah, second screening is what they call it.
Can you explain the plot holes then, if they're repeating everything? Are they forgetting their own plot?
That's just what I heard. That's not my theory.
Like, don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah,
I mean,
a theory.
You know, it's. And I wish it was so simple that it's like one problem we could diagnose to kind of fix what's wrong with mass entertainment. But I think it's really systemic, and so many people are feeling this disconnect. You know, like movies don't feel like they used to. And I used to be able to go to the cinema and I used to be in the habit of going somewhat regularly. My family went somewhat regularly.
$5 Tuesdays.
Yeah.
There was
instead of studios trying to four quadrant every film, which was like where every member of the family is like has something in every film, so that in theory you could bring your whole family and everyone would find something. You know, there was people relied on other models of like you could potentially go to a theater and like the kids would go to one movie and the adults would go to another or like whatever. And I don't know how I got on this tangent. Basically, there's a lot of problems with Hollywood, but at its core is that the storytelling is not moving people in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying that I have any solutions or anything like that, but when you do tell an honest story and tell it with some degree of skill, it's amazing. Because like Withdrawal, 75% of the movie was shot on DV camcorders from 1999, you know, like use like old vintage cameras. I use them because I thought the gritty aesthetic lent itself to the quality of the story, but I expected that aesthetic choice to alienate a lot of audience. They'd come in and say, why does it look like shit? Basically.
But it induces nostalgia.
It does. I mean, listen, I could go on and on about like the merits of that aesthetic choice, but I thought there was a risk involved. Mm-hmm. To see people coming out and just be like, they don't even talk about that. They're just saying, hey, wow. Like I was, from the second this started, I was just locked in. I was so moved by this story that, you know, that's I think is an incredible victory. And it's really exciting to see people discover that in cinema, which is a place that they haven't been feeling that in a long time.
Yeah. There was, and Andrew's going to kill me for saying this, but there's like these video essays. I love video essays, but a little rabbit hole that I've gone down is the marvelification of cinema and like basically how Marvel has ruined movies. But it's about like how it's like, you know, here's this character and like you love the character and like the character is just like, it's just like, here's a hit. And here's another hit, and here's another hit, and it's not, there's no story, it's just kind of like action, and like, okay, now here's like the next great player, and it's just kind of like exhausting, but it looks really cool, there's all these effects, and there's this, that, and the other, like I remember when the Marvel Cinematic Universe was like emerging, and I was like super excited, like Scarlett Johansson was on the screen, I was like, you got me, and you know, it was really exciting, and then for me, like it got old after a while, but then, you know, a lot of art period is like, oh, well, that was successful. How did they do it? Let's recreate it. And it's a lot of recreation, a lot of regurgitation. And like we saw that for a while with all the remakes instead of the new stories. And so it's like people have been burned and frustrated by movies for so long between just everything being the same story in a different font or literally the same story just remade 20 years later. So it's like when there's something new, because a lot of times like what I'll run into is like I'll be in a mood where I'm like, I just want something familiar. You know, like I can't tell you how many times I've watched Dirty Dancing and Perks of Being a Wallflower. Like those are my two movies. They're very, very different films. But those are my two comforts. And a lot of times like I'm just like in the mood for something familiar, because then I know I'm like, well, my trust isn't going to be broken.
Yeah.
But if I put on something new, it might be bad. Because my whole thing is, if I'm on my phone, I'm not going to watch it. Like, you've not captured my interest. And if you haven't captured my interest, why am I watching it?
Yeah.
So I always look for something that makes me not want to pick up my phone. And that's gotten harder, especially with now how saturated with all the different streaming platforms. There's just so much out there. I'm like, I don't know what's good. And I don't care if it's top 10 trending right now. I don't trust the taste of of my fellows.
Yeah.
But I don't know, but to hear that it's a captivating storyline like that. I mean, I've been a writer since I was little. Like, that's what I'm always looking for is a storyline. I feel like that's what so many things are missing. Because yes, the repeating of things, and then the wait, we never circled back to this issue. Like, what's going on here? It's just an art form that is, I feel like, so old and pretentious talking about this, but it's just like an art form that is just kind of getting lost as like attention spans get shorter and shorter.
And. I mean, we're kind of like cracking into like whole conversations about like Hollywood, like what's wrong with Hollywood.
I mean, this is Most High Media.
That's true. That's true. That's true. You know, look, there's a pervasive mindset of scarcity that drives so many of these decisions, and a fear around risk, and I also look like I can empathize with it, you know, like the risk that I've taken on, you know, one of the smallest budget levels that you can operate on is still huge. And like the lifespan of just getting a film made and out into the world, the second you say like, all right, I'm going to go do this, you're signing up for 3 years of your life minimum. And that is the same on the studio level as it is on the independent level. Mm-hmm. So I you get why a lot of like risk mitigating decisions kind of come into that, especially when, you know, you're talking about gigantic sums of money involved. So yeah. I think that's really the root of all evil is the dollar amount combined with the risk. And yeah. Anyway, so yeah, all that to say, it's incredibly, it means the world to me to have made something that of the few, I don't know, a couple thousand people that have seen it at this point, to have consistently heard people find something that they thought was like missing or had like left modern movies. Yeah. And that means the world to me as a fan of cinema throughout the ages. You know, my other job is somehow I've turned talking about old movies into a job. Okay. You know, I've run this podcast called Behind the Slate, where I bring old films to theaters. I give a little intro to try to like acclimate people. It's all about making these older classic films accessible to everybody, and not sort of just like, you know, snobbly, like only for like core nerds.
Like, you're not a real cinephile if you haven't seen this film.
Exactly. Like, so that's that pervasive like 90s video store mentality that we are still fighting against. And despite all the spread of cinema culture online and the spread of Letterboxd and like all these people who are really interested and want to get engaged with this art form, like people are like chomping at the bit. There is still in-person physical spaces sometimes like a little bit of that snobbery. So I really try to work against that, make sure that this is a big tent and open to everybody. And so we do this little intro, we watch the movie, we do this fun audience discussion afterward, very lighthearted, not like heavy, and do lots of little audience videos and everything like that. So yeah, so like the mission all in all is like celebrating cinema, the power that it has, the power of storytelling, and the fact that it like can give so much meaning and like fabric to our lives.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
So going backwards, so what got you into acting and films and pulled you to New York?
I mean, it's just one of those, like, I've just been doing this since I was a little kid. I don't know. I sang in a touring boy choir as a little boy.
Oh, a touring boy choir.
Yeah. I was a soprano as a little boy. Oh. And was in this boy choir that toured all over Europe and shit as a little kid.
Hit a note.
No. I was hitting notes. I mean, I was like 8 years old. I was hitting notes that are inconceivable at the current time. You know.
Wait, but you didn't say it like the guy in The Princess Bride, so I don't think you're a real cinephile.
inconceivable. Of course. So that was my intro to like being on stage. I loved it. I totally just came alive. That led to theater. I was a theater kid all through school, through high school. But I wanted to be a cool theater kid. You know, I wanted to, and I was like, you know, I did a lot of drugs in high school, and I wanted to be like dark and edgy and mysterious. And that was my vibe. Eek is right. I went to NYU drama school, which was you know, that should have been like, man, I should have been so stoked to be there, you know? And on one hand, I was, but I showed up to college, I showed up to NYU already deep into my addiction. I was in high school kind of during like peak or like post peak, like pill mill era. Almost all the boys of my high school senior class, or maybe like, I shouldn't say all, but like 50% of the boys in my senior class all became opioid addicts.
Oh, wow.
Through the accessibility of pills growing up in Georgia in like 2006, 2005. Mm. And so I was already well into addiction by the time I got to college. And then I was in, I was at drama school, and then I discovered this nightclub called The Box, which had just opened, and it was like the coolest nightclub in the world. It was like the Studio 54 of its day, like the super exclusive nightclub, and I could get whatever drugs I wanted. And it had the coolest theater I'd ever seen, because the core of this nightclub was that it had this variety show where you could go and you would see the most mind-blowing spectacles ever. Everything from like acrobatics and like, you know, fire breathers and like whatever, to the like the gritty New York shit where people are like shitting on each other and where there's like sex acts and like all this like crazy stuff. And all of it is like all of it is rendered in this incredible narrative format of this variety show where you're basically like everything is like a little 3-minute play. Mm-hmm. And so when I walked in there as an 18-year-old, I was like, this is heaven.
Someone's shitting on somebody. Sign
well,
me up.
Well, when if you can make someone, it, listen, these people going to at that time, people going to The Box were paying upwards of like $30,000 to $40,000 just to get in the door.
What?
And they're going in for that level of bottle service to then see someone get shit on stage, which they are so revolted that people would actually get up and run out of the theater. That is effective moving performance on a level that is rare. When's the last time you've seen a play where someone ran out of the theater because they thought they were going to vomit? And like, and someone who paid $30,000 to be there. So that's like mind-blowing interaction and play with the audience. And what's crazy about this club is
that's not what's crazy.
No, what's beautiful? What's beautiful about that theatrical experience is that. So there was three shows a night, 12:30, I'm sorry, oh God, I'm getting old, 1, 2, and 3:30 in the morning, okay? And after each show was over, the audience sees these crazy things on stage, and then the magic of theater begins to work on their brains, and they start to think, you know, like, I've seen people doing things I never thought possible. Maybe I could do something crazy. Mm. And so then the party gets a little better. Then the next show comes and the stakes get even higher. By the end of the night, you have people like having sex over the balconies. Like people are laying coke out on the tables. Like, you know, it would just go off the chain. And the club felt like a train that was teetering off the track every night. But this was actually a highly orchestrated theatrical event, which I didn't know until I started working there. So I walked in, I was like, this is the greatest place on earth. I want to live my life here. And but then I did. So I made sure that I could be there all the time. And so I started working there. And that was, it gave me full access to like all the drugs that I ever wanted, all the alcohol that I ever wanted, all the everything else that I ever wanted. And and that became my life while also trying to start an acting career and like all this other stuff. And naturally it all blew up in my face. And then I ended up homeless. So
were you homeless in New York?
Yeah.
For
yeah.
How long?
Oh, it's not that long, like four okay. months.
That's a long time.
Yeah. It was like going into the winter. So I just celebrated my sobriety birthday, which was January 12th.
So. Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations. Thanks. So this was like, everything started to fall apart right around Hurricane Sandy, which was 2012. Okay. Yeah. I got sober on January 12th, 2013.
Nice. And then you moved back to Georgia?
Yeah. I crawled back to Georgia. I was cold. I took a train because I wanted to like carry my drugs with me, and I didn't want to go through airport security, so I took a train on New Year's Eve, and then showed up, and my parents, who were already, you know, things things weren't great and they were quite concerned and they didn't really know what was going on, but like they knew something was wrong. Mm-hmm. They scooped me up at the train station. And
you should write a film about that.
Yeah. there's details of that story that I don't want documented.
Totally fair.
Did you, when your parents scooped you up, did you go to treatment? Did you do things on your own? What did that look like?
So I was living in their house. So I was back in my high school bedroom. I think the biggest thing was like the ego deflation, right? Like it was like, right. I thought I had made it. I was partying with celebrities every night for like all of my late teens and early 20s. And now all of a sudden I'm back in my parents' bedroom, the town I swore I would never come back to. Mm-hmm. I'm so much better than this. So I was mortified. I was ashamed. I was so embarrassed. And I was drinking and I had gotten on Suboxone at this point. I had gotten a Suboxone prescription. Mm-hmm. But I started to go to meetings because I had nowhere else to go. And I had been introduced to them in New York. I was going to meetings in New York because that was the only place I could go get warm and like had coffee. Mm-hmm. I was not interested in getting sober. But someone told me that like I can go and get warm.
But at the clubhouse I go to, there is a man who comes in to get warm and get coffee.
Yeah. I 100% did that when I was homeless too.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And there's sometimes cookies, like hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then sometimes like
I knew which clubhouses. I was like, they have the best snacks. We're going there.
Yeah. But sometimes you're there to get warm and then you're listening to the speaker and you just start crying uncontrollably, you know? It's just like it's kind of weird.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not like these people. Why yeah. am I doing something?
So I'm back in Athens. I started going to meetings, but wasn't committed. I was still using. I mean, we're talking on like a day by day level now because I only lasted 12 days before I picked up a white chip. But somewhere in that meeting, someone read I don't remember where the passage is now. Big Book or 12 and 12. Anyway, like if you're seriously questioning whether or not you're an alcoholic, why don't you go try some controlled drinking?
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So I went out with my high school, a friend from high school, to like do the experiment. And I told him beforehand, hey, you know, this is really important. We got to do we're on a mission, like stop at two. So like, you know, like I'm just telling you beforehand. And of course, like 14 drinks later, we're driving home.
Yeah.
and like, it's not like nothing happened. I dropped him off. I drove back to my parents' house. I just the way I would do in high school, I opened their doorknob very quietly and like try not to wake their dogs and like pulled the door shut. And I remember the second I pulled the door shut and that little click happened, mm-hmm. I remembered the experiment. I was like, fuck. The experiment.
The experiment failed.
The experiment failed. And that was enough. That was enough. Oh, I walked into a meeting. I picked up a white chip the next day. Wow. And that was it.
See, I did the exact same thing the first time I got sober. Yeah, but that was the first time I got sober. Yeah, because I did the whole thing. Like, this woman sat with me, talked with me for a while, and then she was like, why don't you meet me at this other meeting? And I'm like, nope. It's like, I'm going to go home. I'm going to stop at the liquor store first, and I'm going to drink. And she was like, all right, you don't have to. I'm like, but I want to. And I was like, I'm just, you know, I'm not like you. Like, thank you for your time. We are not the same person. Yeah. And I ended up getting shit-faced that night and sent her a really long drunk text. So you might be an alcoholic if.
Yeah.
And then I picked up my white chip the next day. And then, you know, 5 months later, I was like, you know what? Homelessness sounds great. Let's give that one a try. Yeah.
Misery refunded. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, no, the experiment. That part of the book, every time I hear it now, people are like, you know, that's less relevant. They're like, there wasn't fentanyl when this was written. So.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Things have changed a lot. I don't know. It worked for me. But also, that was before fentanyl was even on the scene. So.
Mm-hmm. No, that just aged yourself.
Yeah. But. Yeah. Admitted.
So in the early sobriety, was that when you started writing films and wanting to go in that direction?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Like that first week, I started just like vomiting, you know, out, not vomiting with a pen.
Word vomit.
Word vomiting.
Yeah. I'm still shaking from the shitting story.
For those who are listening only and not watching, Josie just jumped back. Aghast.
Aghast.
You were having withdrawals and you were vomiting.
Yeah, no. Okay, I was kind of post. Well, I was still on Suboxone. I would taper off Suboxone. I picked up a white chip and tapered off the mat.
Okay.
But I did start to write, and pretty soon, just word vomit began to form into like little characters, and I started writing scripts, and I started trying to write my story and like all this sort of stuff. Absolutely the most god awful writing you could ever imagine.
Do you still have it?
Oh yeah, unreadable.
I want to see it.
Oh no, no one has ever seen it.
No, we can exchange.
Never. No, this is in the vault. It's in the vault. I should probably burn it. But no, it is truly god awful. But you got to start somewhere. You got to start somewhere. And that's how I started. But the truth is that it felt so good. It really, really did. I felt it in those moments. That was the only time for the first year, maybe, of sobriety that I truly felt happy, that I was really felt like I was flying. Mm-hmm. And I still feel that way when I really carve out time to sit down and write. And it's still some of the happiest moments of my life.
Do you use it to kind of like make sense of how you're feeling?
Yeah, of course. Not consciously. It's not like you sit down and it's like, okay, like, all right, I'm really going to figure it out right now. No, you just got to start. You just start. It's not, you just got to sit down and just do it. And it's the same, to keep quoting AA phrases, like you have to resign from the debate society of like, why am I doing it? Or like, this is my mission of doing this, or blah, 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 blah. Yeah. You just got to sit down and do it. And the sense only comes afterward. And the meaning only falls into place in hindsight. And so I try to hold on to that more than anything. But but yeah, it ultimately does provide the sense of meaning and emotional expression. For sure.
I think that's great what you said about, it's not about, this is my goal of doing this. Because there's so many times, especially in early sobriety, when I would sit down and try to write. And there's, even in my own journal, where I'm like writing, and then I'll start talking to myself. And I'm like, hey, stop sponsoring yourself. Stop quoting the book. Stop just, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
What are you feeling? And there's like one, there's this book I started writing a couple years ago. And it started because I would do these exercises, because I'd be like, oh, I have to light a candle. I have to have the right music going. I need a cup of tea. Like, I got to do like the whole, like, it's got to be a whole production.
Yeah,
just
the
to
ritual.
Sit down and write, you know? And so I just like, I opened my computer and I just started talking to myself. That's what my warm up is when I write, is I talk to myself by typing. But this particular night, I was just yelling at myself. I was like, just fucking do it. I'm like, if you think you're so fucking funny, then tell the fucking story. Make me laugh, bitch. Bet you won't. Like, yeah. I was... And then I was like, because I just had a story I wanted to get out. And then it started, like, it was a lot bigger than I was anticipating. And so then I got, I think, like 24 pages in. I was like, you know what? I need to take a step back and actually, like, storyboard this and give it direction. But it was, like, that whole thing of, like, hey, we don't need, like, it doesn't need to be, like, this whole, the setting doesn't need to be perfect. I just need to do it. Because, like, I will psych myself out every time. And so that's, like, an active practice in being creative now. Because when I was, like, using and trying to write, I can't tell you how many stories I wrote when I was fucked up. And I never hesitated. I was just, like, I was so high, I didn't care. I'm like, this is what she's doing. And this is what she's doing now. And, you know, in sobriety, I'm like, constantly overthinking and just getting that voice out of my head. Like, you can't edit something that doesn't exist. And so just do it.
Yeah. Now, well, this gets into a dynamic that I'm quite fascinated by. I find really interesting and something that I continue to struggle with, which is that, because some people will hear this and think that, well, it's not fair, because some people just like, they just show up and you just have to do it, right? So you just start doing it and then you can, you know, you can make something of merit. And that's actually not true. We're talking about two separate things, right? So there's the talent of the craft of whatever it is that you're trying to do, which requires technique, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I have a very systematic approach that I take at this point that I've developed, you know, just my own way of doing things over many, many years of how I approach storytelling, and I outline and do, I go through all these steps or whatever to try to save myself time. But what you're talking about, and the dynamic that we're talking about of like the needing to get over the self-censorship or whatever you have, mm-hmm. is the thing that I like to call the talent for your talent, right? Mm-hmm. You have your talent, and you've got to develop that with a certain set of techniques and skills. The challenge of becoming an adult artist is that you have to nurture this talent for your talent. How do you protect that little talent that you've had since you were a child? How do you keep the world from like blowing out that little flame? And then furthermore, how do you develop a sense of practices where all of us have imaginations, have creative inclinations, but if you really feel a calling toward the arts, your gift is your imagination. Well, how do you keep that imagination from not spinning off in a million directions about like what other people think about you and what's going to happen in the future and like all the reasons of like why I suck, right? Like my imagination will go in those directions very, very easily. And I have to develop the talent for my talent to recognize it and you know, do whatever I have to do to try to keep the talent from going off in self-destructive avenues. Yep. Because wasn't that those type of narratives such a self-perpetuating part of my addiction, right? Like if I live in that world too long, like it'll lead me back to like where I came from. So yeah, I love that sort of that idea, and I think it's really important for people to keep in mind that it's like we have to nurture these two sides, the technical skill of whatever task it is that you're doing, but also how to protect that personally.
Yeah, because it's like at this point, you know, because at first it was like, I'm not doing this thing at all, and this is a thing that I love. And so I had to like do that weird little thing just to start doing the thing again. And now it's definitely two different practices. So when it's like, when my imagination is going 400 different directions, it's like, cool, I might not have a story to write right now. Yeah. I might just have some words I need to vomit onto this sheet of paper, you know, and then, because it's very different where it's like, where like writing is very therapeutic and very cathartic. And so it's like, that's a whole different process, right? This is I need to do this because I'm super anxious or I'm feeling some big emotions and I need to just get them out, versus I have a story I want to tell, like this, I need to organize this. This is what's going on. It's two very, they're both writing, but they're two very, very different. They look very different and they turn out very different. Like one, I would show my therapist, be like, fix me. And then the other one, I might show other people.
For sure.
But, as we come in for a close, what would you say the impact creativity had on your recovery from the beginning to where you are now?
Yeah, it's hard to quantify. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's in some ways, it's really one of the only things that has stayed consistent from the before time to sobriety. But it's certainly changed. It certainly got a lot happier and healthier and like more fun in sobriety. I think that by holding on to a creative practice, it you know, some of the things that we've already said, it allowed me to find a through line of my own life, so that I could make sense of my own story, and hopefully, you know, have the willingness and the courage to share that with somebody else, and trusting that if I share it honestly, others will relate to it, right? That's another gift that AA gave to me, that the program gave to me, the sense of like, if you share in a general but kind of specific way, other people will feel it and allow and see themselves in that, even mm-hmm. even from someone from such a completely different side of the world than you, and that's not just a program thing, that is one of the most beautiful things about being a human that we get to experience is that common humanity through storytelling. That has stayed true, and I'm grateful for that. It has also, by keeping up a creative practice into sobriety, it has taught me that I do not need to be a crazy person to be creative or interesting, mm-hmm. which is maybe the most quintessential lie or just like stupid belief that I had as a young person. I thought that I had to be crazy and... I thought I had to be crazy to be interesting. Essentially, I thought no one would love me or respect me if I aspired to a degree of normalcy. And I am so grateful to be relieved of that narrative in my life, where I, because it's actually the inverse. You know, I live an incredibly, by the standards of my 18-year-old self, I live an incredibly boring life. I'm married with two kids, and I like...
Not the boring life followed by your wife.
No.
And my life's boring. I'm married.
Wow. Wow. Called out. Shub, that's not what I meant. No, the idea that it's like you're gonna have this nuclear family, and yeah, you're not gonna go out to clubs and like, or go like looking for trouble and like seeking out danger to justify your existence. You know what I was talking about?
I know.
Yeah, why? Really putting me on blast here.
It was for the trauma. I know.
God, I do feel embarrassed though. It's okay. I'm gonna have to take the shame. I gotta take the shame.
Not living the bachelor lifestyle, the sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Yeah,
cookie cutter life.
I thought the fact that the second it hits 8 o'clock, like, it's very hard to get me out of my house. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it takes a lot. Your movie better be fucking good.
Well, thanks for being here after 8 o'clock.
Well,
I didn't know it was such a high honor.
Well, yeah, finally, you're starting to recognize the stakes of the situation. the fact that what I was trying to say.
I'm so sorry.
Is that, in many ways, the more boring my life gets, the more crazy and interesting my work gets. That I get to have a level of freedom and risk taking in my work, and it is inversely proportional to the degree of risk taking in my personal life. And that is like the most, I feel like I've discovered like the secret, you know what I mean? I think about, you know, artists like Stanley Kubrick, who like people have told all these like crazy myths about the tortured genius Stanley Kubrick, who was obsessed with like every detail and drove his actors crazy. The truth of the matter is that
I like that voice.
Yeah. Well, the truth of the matter, that's the only time you're going to hear it. The truth of the matter is that Stanley Kubrick was this, he was a very nerdy family man who was just devoted to his wife and children. He just wanted to work at home, and he wanted no one to bother him because he just loved his work. And he made these crazy movies that not only revolutionized the art form, but told crazy stories. He put crazy things on screen, and you'd think, you just watch some of like The Shining or The Clockwork Orange, whatever, you'd say, what madman came up with this? And he's actually like the most normcore it could be. That's my goal at this point, you know what I mean? Like, that is what I'm aspiring to. And anyway, that is such a wild change from my mindset when I was 20.
Mm-hmm. well said.
I like that a lot. Well, excuse me, how can people support the film Withdrawal?
Oh yes. Gosh, it's gone. We've gone this whole way, and I haven't even talked about like dates. I haven't even done any plugs.
Yeah, plug it.
Boop, boop. So Withdrawal.
Careful, it's getting past that time.
I thought you were afraid of the pooping. You know, you want to plug it.
That's why I want to plug it.
Whoa, guys.
Just make sure you stretch first. So anyway, Withdrawal is about to play, it's about to come back to theaters here in Atlanta and in Athens, Georgia for 2 week-long runs. I cannot tell you what an amazing opportunity this is. Again, for a micro-budget film with zero marketing budget, we're going to be playing in theaters for 2 straight weeks. So it's coming to the Plaza Theater in Atlanta, starting on January 30th and running through February 5th. It'll be playing every day for that week. It then goes to Athens, plays February 6th through the 12th. It's going to be awesome. We have a different community partner every night. We'll have Q&As with a sort of revolving group of the cast and crew every day. It's going to be a party. It's going to be so much fun. Ooh. So anybody in the Atlanta and Athens, Northeast Georgia area, please come out and check it out. You know, if you don't live in the Georgia area, what you can do is you can follow us on Instagram at at Withdrawal Film. And there we post all of sort of our announcements. So what we're going to do is we're using these two theatrical weeks to get a bunch of ticket data and all this sort of marketing materials that then we're going to take to theaters all over the country. So if you want this film to come to your town, you can hit us up. And I would love to hear from you. And you, and I don't care where it is. You tell me where you want the film to go, and we, let's work together to get the film there. We'll go to your indie theater and say, hey, we've got somebody in your town. You know, maybe they have some friends that they know that they want to see this movie. That's oftentimes all an indie theater needs to take a risk on an unknown film like this. So so follow at Withdrawal Film. You can also follow me personally on TikTok at Stranded on Stage, which is where I'm posting all of my withdrawal content on TikTok. And just hit me up. Yeah, shoot me a DM, leave a comment or whatever, and I will get in touch with you. I'm the one running all the socials. So I will hit you up and we will make this happen. And we're going to be bringing this film across the country throughout the year. And then I would expect probably by the end of the year, it'll be available on streaming. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that yet, but it will happen in one way or another. And so, that's kind of all the ways that you can engage. And I would just love, if anybody's interested in seeing the film, I would just love to hear from them and let's make it happen together.
Hell yeah.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. This has been an awesome episode. Anything you want to close out with, Sarah? Any closing thoughts? Anybody here? Live studio audience, anything you want to say? Okay, great. All right. So thank you so much for coming tonight. You can check out the Most High Media app in the description box in on YouTube, where you can find this episode and previous episodes. You can also follow Most High Media on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. So just make sure to give us a follow, like, subscribe, everything else. This show has been brought to us tonight and been made possible by the Georgia Opioid Crisis Abatement Trust. Thank you, and thank you to our donors and sponsors. This has been the Most High Show. Good night.